reason for the ecstasy. Maybe they all know they are doomed because of their own nature, and they want to live in the sun while it shines. How long can this ruse really last? I have stayed quiet to assess the situation. Well, after my initial shock wore off, I have learned much. My real brother loathed the Bone Riders. He mocked them behind their backs. But the best soldiers are often the hollow ones, whom you can fill with your own purpose. This clone doesn't know he's supposed to hate the Bone Riders. He was raised by a woman who worshipped the Jackal and the Bone Riders, and thought the two inseparable. How disappointed the clone must be in the legends he was raised on. I sit at his left hand, a place of secondary honour. Lilith eats her hummingbird eggs across the table from me. She feeds like a pelican, head down, eyes up. Slurp, slurp, slurp. Like clockwork, her eyes flick to the clone to make sure he has everything he needs. When he stops drawing with his stylus on a data pad after a pink screams from a Bone Rider arrow, Lilith bolts to attention. It is almost grotesque to see how quickly the dead-eyed killer melts into suffocating sycophant. "What is it, my Emperor? Do you possess everything you need?" Lilith loved my brother. I've always known it. But now that love is something wrong. She would have been his lover, but he liked pretty harpies like Antonia. So instead, Lilith gave birth to his clone. I do not believe I understand psychology enough to try to unravel that. But I wager the clone has. And that is the vulnerability of this little cabal. I glance up at the arrayed fleets. In reply to Lilith's query, the clone forms a simple three-dimensional puzzle on his datapad and flicks the floating image to her off his datapad. "Can you solve that?" Sitting up straighter, she peers at it. Slowly, her eyes lose their gleam as she realizes she doesn't even know there is a puzzle. He looks at me to make a joke of her. I never thought I'd see Lilith squirm from shame. Her influence is slipping. She did fail him with the abduction of Pax and Electra. Now she is frightened I will steal him away, and he is afraid that I will let him down like these Bone Riders have. How long did it take for his mind to be useful to her, I wonder? Has it been 4 years? 5? She did much on her own, but how long will he need her now that he has his other Bone Riders? Now that he has the Vox Legions through his puppets? She must wonder. She must be afraid. And he must be annoyed that he is still so small. I know where to drive the wedge. If he had all he needed, Lilith, I would already be a blank slate, wouldn't I? She says nothing. The clone watches intently as I solve the puzzle, add 2 new polygons, and spin it back to him. He looks at it for a moment, and then smiles in delight. He adds a fresh twist to the puzzle and hurls it back. This volley lasts the better part of 30 excruciating minutes as the fleets probe one another over our heads. I have a strange feeling inside as he pauses the game to spend several minutes on a separate datapad making adjustments to his battle plan. The ships above move according to his wishes after a slight delay. His last volley was an oddity. He did not try to beat me with it. In fact, he seemed surprised and then delighted to see I could solve his puzzles. After that, he was just having fun. By the third puzzle, so was I. I would have given fingers off my hand for my twin to sigh like that when we were children. All my life, I thought my brother was born broken. He wasn't. Perhaps he was just born with an incompatible father. "Do you remember our puzzles?" I probe the clone as he watches 2 destroyers test the Telemana's flank. He frowns as they are repelled. "I know they occurred," he says, giving new orders through his datapad. "Evidence here and there." I glance at Lilith with a smile. The puzzles defined my relationship with my brother. I don't know how many he gave me over the years, but I know how many I kept. I solved each one, and he'd smile and congratulate me. But sometimes I would follow him and see him slapping himself and gouging his skin, screaming, "Stupid, stupid, stupid." If this was his insurance plan, he'd have given his clone all the information he needed to become himself again. The puzzles were a key component of a rivalry that shapes his psyche. He would have included the puzzles. And if he'd included them, he wouldn't have been surprised I could solve the ones during our volley. The fact that he was surprised is the loose thread I've been looking for. I glance up at the fleets as he lures a Telemannus corvette into a trap and pull on the thread as quickly as I dare. "I'm surprised you enjoyed me solving these," I say. "What do you mean?" "It used to anger you so." He stares at me. "Did it? Don't you remember? Sometimes you would hit yourself and call yourself stupid for failing to fool me." "Did I ever?" "No." He puzzles over that for a moment, then looks at Lilith. Is it possible that she redacted some of the information Adrius passed down to his clone? By the look on his face, it isn't the first time he's wondered it. "She's lying," Lilith says, seeing the wedge but not knowing how to blunt it. "Killing is more her game." "You are the brightest mind in this solar system." "Ah, so there's the difference. This clone has been raised to believe he is a god. My brother was kicked and beaten and left on a rock to die more than once. One earned his victories. The other feels entitled to them." "Are you doing this for Lilith?" I ask the clone. "Or is it for Adrius?" "I am Adrius," he says. "Do you want to be?" He tilts his head to examine me as the Martian fleet withdraws to reassess their strategy after losing two more corvettes. "Don't let her pour poison in your ear, my Emperor. She always thought you were a monster," Lilith says to him. Turning to me, she says, "You betrayed him to slaves. You abandoned your own brother. You hung him from the gallows yourself. He should have been worshipped by the world, but you just stepped all over him. You hated him. You called him a monster." "If I hated him, why did I pull his feet?" I ask. "If I didn't love him, why would I keep those puzzles?" Lilith goes still. "Eat that, bitch." The clone activates, leaning forward. I suspected artifacts from Adrius's life would be of almost religious importance to him. Practically feeling the evil vibrations from the clone, the Bone Riders stop their play and watch in silence. God, they could just snap him in half, but they're afraid of him. Not just that, they respect him, worship him. It really runs that deep. I had no idea. I thought it was just Lilith. Did my brother tell them if they lost, he would free them in 10 years' time? Is he a leader? Or a prophet? "Where are those puzzles?" the clone asks. "My private office. On Mars. Here." He remains perfectly still. "Lilith," she swallows, "did I not tell you to leave my sister's quarters as they were?" He waits. And waits. The Bone Riders watch with smiles as the 10-year-old spanks maybe the hardest woman on all of Luna, and she just takes it. They all want to be number two. So there's this Pax dynamic. "Answer, Lilith." "You did. So why disobey me?" He leans forward. "Did you plan the Day of Red Doves? Did you use the White Guilds to start a war?" What does he mean by that? "You are a blunt instrument, Lilith. You know this. I treat you with respect, and you dare meddle with my designs." "I thought they would prove a distraction, sir. I pray for your sake they have not been destroyed." "No," she says, "you made them." "Where are they?" I ask, hoping I'm right. The clone stands up. "You heard my sister, Lilith. She may not be our ally, but she is of better blood than you. Answer her with due respect." Lilith looks at me with abject hatred. "In my quarters." The clone looks disgusted, as if he'd found her going through his drawers to smell his underwear. "Have them restored to their original locations. I will view them at once." "But the battle..." He glances at the Telemannus fleet, which makes no new movements towards the planet. "They have little appetite for blood. They're trying to break through our jammers to broadcast to the people. We have time." The clone stands in my private office, staring at the puzzles Lilith took from the room to hide for herself. He has not spoken for 5 minutes. I am surprised Lilith found the hidden vestibule behind the wall. It seems, however, she did not find the hidden passage within it. "Must that low blood watch us like this?" I ask him. "She looks like a jealous vulture." "Leave us," he says almost in a whisper. Lilith's cold eyes dart to me. "My Emperor, it would not be wise." I flop down in a chair near a coffee table covered with books and a vase of night lilies. "Paralyze my legs if you're so afraid." The clone eyes the table behind me with suspicion. "There were defense-related systems located in the table," Lilith reports. "We deactivated them, my Emperor." "And the dining table?" "Deactivated as well." The clone points to a different chair at the small dining table and another vase of assorted flowers, almost all of which are dead. I sit in the chair and he paralyzes my legs via the psychospike. "See, that wasn't so hard," I say. He turns to Lilith. "If she kills me, she kills Sevro and the others. If she'll pay that price, she's earned it." Lilith lowers herself into a wary bow and backs with our two sober Bone Rider escorts toward the door. The clone looks back at the puzzles. I was hoping it wouldn't be paralysis, but nothing is easy. "I know you are playing a game," the clone says as the door closes, "but I don't fault you for it. This all started as a game. It wasn't until 4 years ago I heard my recording to myself." Lilith had instructions to follow, a psychological profile of the proper puppet to sponsor for a Senate run. Publius fit my specifications perfectly. She did take control of the syndicate on her own, but the underworld wasn't prepared for her level of violence. She is possibly one of the most effective soldiers I have ever seen. That's both of me talking. But she only goes in one direction at a time. He walks down the lines of the puzzle, passing very near to the idle night lilies. The flowers, uncared for, droop in their vases. Many are dead. She would tell it to me all like a story at first, then presented it to me as a problem set. Given the variables, which gang to kill, which product to sell, I liked it better when it was stories. I was a hero in them. Or he was. He stops in front of a maze. "But we're not. And I know why. Lilith took me to a slaughterhouse on Earth when I was young, and I saw how they would kill the cows and then make them into food for us to eat. Tell me, why are cows different from people? Cows have dreams. Cows have affection for their friends and family. If you are going to say it is because cows are less intelligent than people, it is acceptable to slaughter them. Why is it not acceptable for me to slaughter people who are proportionately less intelligent to me than cows are to them? And if you say it is because people feel more, then I invite you to stab a cow and a human in the throat and see how very similar they are." As he speaks, my eyes search the vase of the flowers looking for a live one. "That's false equivalency. Logical fallacies are beneath you," I say. "You know it's true," he replies. I look back to him from the flowers, just before he glances back. "Deep down, that's what I care about, because I can talk to you and I know you hear me. I was promised that with the Bone Riders, but they are aberrant monkeys. From Lilith's lips, you would believe they were seraphs." "You hated them before, too," I say. "Did I?" he asks, sounding almost relieved. "You thought them ridiculous. They are venal. And did I hate father?" "No. I shot him in the head." "You loved father as a father should be loved. But he didn't love you back. That was the problem. You thought it was your fault. There were many things that were your fault, but not that. I think what I've realized is that every father makes a mess of things. It's just a matter of if he cared when he did it. Our father didn't, and I think you spotted that. Then why are you, and why am I me?" he asks, turning around completely. because I gave up trying to please him, and you never did. I honestly don't think you ever cared about any of this. I waved to the walls around us. With every new endeavor, there's always the hope that you will find happiness, be less lonely. Let me tell you what I've learned. The moment you become sovereign, you become the loneliest person in all the world, because there is no new endeavor, no new height to which you can ascend. Whatever loneliness is already inside you is magnified, because if you were lucky enough to have anyone understand you before, they won't understand you after you sit in the morning chair. Only one person, alive at a time, knows what it means to be sovereign. He traces the lines in the marble floor with his toe, as if it were a puzzle. I glance back at the flowers. There could be one alive on the other side of the vase. "Do you know why I did this?" he asks. "I did it because Lilith told me it was the only way I could see you. You would kill me if you were not at my mercy. I know. You think I am a freak, and I am. But thank you for speaking to me as if I weren't. I recognize the gesture, even if it isn't a kindness." "Do you hate her?" I ask him. "Lilith." He replies with a slight pause and no inflection in his voice. "On the day she took me to see the cows die, I had a thought. I asked Lilith to build me an iron cow. She built me the iron wolf instead, as I knew she would. One day soon, I will melt her inside it." I forget the flowers and stare at him. "Why?" "Because she doesn't understand irony." He means it, and he doesn't sound upset, proud, or even excited about it. "And doing that would make you feel happy?" I ask. "It doesn't make me feel anything. It's just an opportunity for novelty." To do that to Lilith, who gave birth to him, who breastfed him, who woke in the middle of the night when he cried as a baby, who trained him to walk, to speak, to read, seems in the moment to be the cruelest act I have ever heard. My brother was many things, but even his evil led with the heart. This thing is just bored. "Just like making the Republic eat itself," I ask. "Indeed," he smiles, pleased. "I knew if anyone could understand me, it would be you. I only wish Father were here. Cruel though he may have been, so I could see this cruelness, look in the eye, smell its ugly breath, to see if I felt it." "Felt what?" "Evil. What precipice of the mind could conjure anything more terrifying than a cruel father?" "I think," I say slowly, "perhaps you have spent too much childhood indoors, young man." He reels back, annoyed that I dare try to pull out of the discussion with affected rhetoric. In his mind, it is disrespectful. "You don't think I'm Adrius at all, do you?" he asks. His mood darkens. "I suppose to you this must all feel as if you were with a voyeur." He gestures to the puzzles. "I am not real to you. I am an interruption. At very best, an imposter." His lips pull upward as his eyes narrow. "Am I wrong?" "Nah, kid, you're not wrong. If Adrius was here, he would be eating lobster as he gave this lecture on a table containing the body of a conquered foe. If Adrius were here, he'd have sex slaves brought to him after the battle and fuck them on Octavia Auloon's bed. And it would make him so very happy to dilute the most expensive liquor bottles with piss and then give them to his bone riders to share. And then, after all that, he'd tell it all to no one. His war on the world was a joke built around a central need to prove he didn't yearn for the approval from the only man who wouldn't give it. You, on the other hand, are just a joke built around me, a visitor to this world who doesn't belong, a ghost." He looks stricken. I finish it. "And what Father was to Adrius, I am now to you." He steps closer, as if to confess. "It would appear so." Emotion leaks into his voice. "It must end in your death, then, I suppose." I spot the flower I need. It's moments like this I sympathize with Darrow. There is a patient, longer scheme available, where I earn the clone's trust over days, even weeks. I could fix more things then, perhaps. I could ensure the rescue of Sevro, Pebble, and Clown. But if I wait so long, how much of the Republic will be left by the time I am in a position to save it? The fleets will be at it again soon, if they aren't already. Both navies were built to protect us from the Golds. The prospect of their destruction at the hands of each other is more urgent a calamity than the safety of my friends. I make the same choice my husband had to make. It doesn't have to be that way, I say to the clone. I am not like father because I do care about you, even if I don't love you. You killed my friends when you didn't have to. Lilith put that in you. What I said, it was in reaction to that. I don't want to be your enemy. There are things Lilith is wrong about, things that will jeopardize your life. For instance, the Pandemonium chair. Did you know Octavia only used it twice? It is dangerous. Are you trying to tempt me into asking for the codes to the Crescent Vault? He asks. No, I say. I'm trying to tempt you into asking about my research with the Pandemonium chair, how the Psycho Spike functions. He lifts his datapad and sends tendrils of pain racing along my spine. I think I've discovered it for myself. Of course, but you haven't cracked how to actually erase the memories, have you? They're quite different functions, viewing and destroying, and more than 24 steps to the latter. I lean forward with a smile. He couldn't figure out the puzzle. I'm sorry. Rude of me to not put in an easy little button for idiots. He wants to know how to do it so he can do it to me and make me his companion. What sort of companion, I can only guess. He looks scolded, but walks closer. And you would just tell me? In time, all things are possible, brother. I pick the night lily out from amongst the dead flowers in the vase, and I hand it out to him, the way Bellona knights did as they returned to loved ones from war. His response is a basic human response. When you're caught off guard and someone reaches to shake your hand in a comfortable setting, you usually shake it. When someone displays a deep and respectful flash of cultural esoterica that you value as well, you respond. He does both. If he had had proper kinesthetic training by a razor master, he wouldn't. After all, genius or not, he is still only 10 years old. He takes the flower. But he doesn't take it the way I would. Or the way Adrius would. He takes it like an entitled child who spends too much time indoors. Violently. Chapter 57. Virginia. Black Cathedral. Night lilies respond well to a gentle touch. They do not abide rough handling. That's when their necrotic spines come out to play. I had them made that way, as my last in a long line of redundant defences, all of which have either been deactivated or removed, except my bloody damn flowers. Precisely because it is more in line with something Atalantia would have lying around than Virginia au Augustus. The clone flinches as several sets of glistening needles burst from the flower to pierce his thumb. He screams at the sudden blinding pain. The shaded toxins of the lily trickle slowly down the tip of his thumb, spreading toward his hand. He falls backward, staggered by the intensity of the poison. I feel the agony as well. It seeps from my right index finger, up my arm, straight to my spinal column. I almost throw up, but I must move. I throw my body forward off the chair to the floor near the clone's datapad. He dropped it the second after the needles went in. The flower's spines have retracted. I pick it up very gently. Flower in one hand, pad in the other. I crawl to the puzzle wall, trying to turn off the psycho spike without getting another dose of the spreading poison. The third puzzle at the bottom on the left is a transponder to the escape door. This puzzle had to be on the door for it to open, and not hidden in Lilith's creepy suite. If I press my hand to the wall when the puzzle is present, the door will slide up, and I can escape. If I can just get to it. The door to the hall explodes inward as Lilith responds to her Emperor's cries. She's carrying two hatchets, She runs toward me. I find the right function on the data pad and return sensation to my legs. I scramble upward and lunge to touch the wall behind the pictures without disturbing the flower in my hands. A jarring force hits my back. It almost feels like a punch compared with the searing pain in my index finger. The necrotic poison is spreading for the hand. If it gets to the torso, I'm dead. But by the wrist, I'll be in such agony I won't be able to move. I slam my other hand into the wall. The wall shoots straight upward to reveal a metal chute at waist height. I duck and drop the flower just as Lilith tries to chop my head off from behind. I try to spin kick her legs, but she steps over the kick and delivers a slash downward. I catch it on my left forearm. The bone breaks so abruptly that it pierces the skin. I stumble back into the wall beside the chute and reach for the flower with my poisoned hand. Lilith is brutal and effective. She chops me in the left shoulder, takes off my right ear, then buries a crushing blow in the right side of my ribcage. The bones break, and something inside me ruptures. I crumple downward, just close enough to the flower. Lilith glances back at her emperor, knowing I'm mortally wounded, but unable to detect why he's screaming. Almost blind with pain, I fumble for the flower with my poisoned hand. Another dose of poison goes through two more of my fingers. My vision pulses, and I hurl the flower up at Lilith's face. It is the only part of her not covered with armor. I don't see where it hits her, I just hear her screaming. She stumbles away, almost dropping her hatchet. Something clanks on the wall behind where I stand. It's connected to me. I reach backward and find metal. I pull on it till I feel pressure release in my back. It's one of Lilith's hatchets. I look at her, and I stumble from the pain and loss of blood as I wind up to throw it at her. She's hunched beside the clone. There's a ripping sound, and she stands up with a shudder. It was her nose the needles got, and she didn't take any chances with how much of her nose she cut off. She turns back to me and pulls another hatchet from the sheath on her thigh to join the bloody one she already has. I throw my hatchet at her. She doesn't bother dodging, it just sparks off her armor. I lose faith in the fight, and I dive into the escape hole to plunge forward. The ride is a minute almost straight down through darkness. The tunnels go almost as deep as the Dragonmoor bunker. The tube levels off and deposits me on a soft landing pad in a small room. It is one of the Citadel's secondary fallback bunkers. There are four tubes that can access it. I pull a lever to close all four. They might have found everything else in my office, but not this. I'm going to pass out from blood loss soon. I rush past the weapons cases to the medical station. Arm broken, I clumsily grab the laser saw first. The blue line of energy comes to life. Without hesitating, I slice off my index finger at the bottom joint. The pain of the amputation and cauterization are meager compared with that of the Lily's toxins. I leave the gouge where my ear used to be, weeping blood. The flow has already diminished and will stop soon from coagulation. I take off the middle finger at the top joint and just the tip of the ring finger. I discard the laser cutter and reach for the cauterizing gun. No time for anything pretty. Even with it, my internal organs will likely keep bleeding in a rupture. I moan over the medical table in pain as the gun melts close the wound on my right side. Then I seal the other ones I can reach. I thought I would face a dire choice, to save Severo and my friends or to save myself. Now I realize there is no choice. If I don't get out, I will die, and so will the fleet in orbit. I have to get out. I take three shots of stims to stay awake, then pump blood from the med station supply into myself as I sit woozily in front of the communications terminal. It is located beside the ejection chute. The terminal is already in Black Cathedral protocol. Someone else must have called it. Cavax? Holiday? The hidden network immediately connects me to the bridge of the Reynard, Cavax's flagship. He turns to see me on his displays. Sophocles tilts his head toward the camera. Cavax, I am in the small chapel. The man's eyes widen. Flashes from battle wash over his face. I have internal bleeding in the kidneys, and likely the liver. Left arm is broken, right hand losing function. Severo, Clown, and Pebble are also prisoners in the Sun Hall. How many clergy in the building? 4, but they are in Moon Hall and connecting tunnels are compromised. I won't be able to go to them, I say, looking down at my wound. Do you know where the prisoners are located? No. Can you find out? He asks. Giving you access to internal cameras still connected to the systems, I say. Kavax, make the call. I'll go back for them if you think I can make it. He and his techs sort the feeds for a few moments to find the ones I sent. As they do, I examine the defense systems I had installed in the Citadel. Nearly all of them are dark. Lilith and the clone peeled my fortress apart. Oddly, the escape and transit systems are the only systems running. Likely so the clone and the Bone Riders could move about behind the scenes while they pulled the strings of their puppet government. Kavax is done appraising the information I sent. Where are they? I ask. Let me see your wounds. I turn them toward the camera. Eject, he says. We have teams on the ground ready to move at exit. Eject. My heart wants to be the person who risks it for Severo in the face of certain death. My head can't decide. But in this situation, the person on his end of the line is the boss. Kavax has operational control. I look emptily at the ejection tube. Is this what it comes down to? Leaving the best of my friend in the clutches of a ghost from my past? I suppose so. Severo was right. I am not Mustang any longer. I am the Sovereign. I crank open the ejection hatch, crying out from the pain as I use my broken arm. I feel very selfish as I crawl through the aperture into a small padded compartment large enough to fit 10. I close the hatch behind me, and the lights in the compartment and in the concrete tunnel glow. Electricity channels through the 2 metal rails on either side of the tunnel, and the compartment shoots forward. It carries me away from not only Severo, Clown, and Pebble. It carries me away from the place Daxo died, and the people who killed him. It takes me away from 10 years of work in a place I had always feared. I had dreamed of one day leaving the Citadel of Light behind, perhaps ousted from office in a hard-fought election against a worthy successor, or after my relevance had worn out. I once hoped it would be Dancer who took it on next. Never did I imagine my last time leaving the Citadel would be like this. As the compartment races along the 40-kilometer tunnel, I make myself a promise that this will be the second to last time I leave the Citadel. I will return to finish this, and then I will never see this place again. It feels like a dream when the compartment slows to a stop. The hatch pops open above my head, and I emerge. Large men in armor stand waiting for me. But then their rifles rise, and I see the Vox upside-down pyramid on their armor. I stand there with my hands in the air, feeling myself fading. Gunfire comes from the hall, and before the men can turn around, the wall behind them erupts. High-powered rounds mow them down in seconds. A team of heavily armed Lion Guard and Pegasus Legion soldiers burst in from the hall, hunched over their weapons. The battered helmet of a Pegasus Centurion retracts to reveal Holiday T. Nakamura. "Lie down, ma'am," she barks. 2 of her men expand a peculiar stretcher with 2 large pods on each end. Holiday forces me down onto it. I make no arguments. I can barely walk. "Reynard, this is Grey Rock. I have Gold Horse. We are on the move." The stretcher locks me in place. I see what the pods are for when an intense pulse field throbs between them with a thrum. 2 soldiers carry the stretcher as Holiday leads a squad out of the room. Gunfire echoes through the halls. Gunship engines roar outside as we ascend the bunker via the stairs. Dozens of Vox Legionnaires lie dead. More of Holiday's lurcher squads join us. They look like a troop of evil gargoyles as they push from the bunker in force out into the light of day. We're in one of my brother's craters. Now I see why Kavax didn't send in men through the tunnel earlier. It's in the center of a Vox Mobile Infantry Legion headquarters. Lion Guard and Pegasus Legion gunships lay waste to the camp. Holiday leads the Special Forces troopers straight into the back of a waiting assault transport. Its guns rattle as we lift off as soon as I'm aboard. 50 Pegasus troopers activate their boots and fly close behind the transport as the door seals. The war becomes a distant rumble. A medical team waiting in the assault shuttle rushes to me. Before I can object, they sedate me. I feel our escape from atmosphere distantly through the bumps that resonate through the deck. When I go weightless, I know we have made it to space. When the shuttle wheezes to a stop and clunks down on a deck, I know I have made it to the Reynard. I close my eyes and succumb to the loss of blood. I wake to find Darrow's mother asleep at my bedside with Sophocles in her arms. The ship is quiet. It seems they disengaged with the Fox fleet. Monitors above me track my vitals. I am in the Reynard's medical bay. Sophocles wakes up first and gives a little yip and jumps on my bed. I wince as pain races through my right side from my wound. "Stupid animal," Deanna says, swatting it away. She wipes sleep from her eyes and looks down on me with such protective love that I start to cry. Not for myself, but for her. For the pain I see in her eyes, and all the pain she must have felt these last days for her son, for her grandson, for Severo, for me. And then I cry for Daxo and Theodora and the friends I left behind with the monster. She cradles me as I do, humming in my ear, as I have always wished my mother had done for me. Hours later, when I've worked up the strength, Kavax and Niobe come to see me. I worry for a moment that Nakamura was too ashamed to come, but then Deanna drags her inside. Holiday can barely meet my eyes for the shame of letting me be captured. It wasn't her fault. I was thoroughly undone. I'd weep again to Kavax and Niobe for Daxo. But all that needs to wait.
"Has Heliopolis fallen?" I ask.
"Not yet," Kavax says, "but our agents say it only has days left." "Darrow?" I ask. "We don't know," Niobe says.
"Pax?"
Kavax can't answer, so Niobe does. "Ephraim T. Horn abducted them from the Obsidium. Their whereabouts are currently unknown."
"Abducted them? Again?"
"We don't know why, but it occurred immediately after the Pandora was hit. Victra is missing. Her escape shuttle was found, but the first rescue team was shot down crossing Obsidian airspace. Her legions were grounded on the orders of the Arch-Governor, for fear they would initiate a war with Sephi's Obsidian." I lean forward in hope.
"Rolo survived, then?"
"He's a good man. Stalwart. Tough, loyal, and he was a son of Ares." "No," Holiday says. "They assassinated him in Aegea." I sink into the bed.
"Well, then it's Voril."
They shake their heads.
"They got him too. Well, then who took the post?"
"Some idiot," Deanna says.
"Kieran,"
Kavax answers heavily. "Temporary appointment by Mars's regional governors."
"Darrow's brother.
I sent him to Mars with Niobe to negotiate with the Obsidian. I'm hopelessly behind. Wait, no, Publius and Zahn mentioned this.
Who assaulted the ship?"
"It looks like Sephi," Kavax says. I just blink at him.
"I never thought we should have trusted that mongrel breed. First the coppers, then the crows."
Looking up at them, I just realize that they think Publius did all this. I don't have time to explain. Calming her husband, Niobe shows me the current disposition of ships in the system.
Atalantia is still massed at Mercury, with a smaller fleet at Venus.
Most of the Republic battleships are here around Luna, while the Ecliptic Guard gathers over Mars. "Is this fleet strong enough to break through Ash Armada over Mercury?" I ask Kavax.
"Yes,"
Kavak says. No, Niobe corrects. We cannot defeat them without Ecliptic Guard or the Vox fleet joining us. We might be able to break through as is, but to land and load under fire. She stiffens. A miracle could occur. Or it could be the greatest disaster of the war. We have to try, Kavak says. Darrow would for us. Deanna heads to the door. Deanna, stay, I say. No, she says gruffly. Maybe I can one day forgive you for doing what needs doing. But I can't give you permission to abandon my boy. She steps out. Holiday still has not weighed in. Virginia, there's something else you need to know, Niobe says. The Rim has made a secret alliance with the Corps. It can't get any worse. Fresh ships, fresh legions of enemies, thrown into the fray at the exact moment they could break our backs. They are currently unaware we have this intel. We don't know where they will strike, but we can assume it will be decisive. She looks at her husband. Mercury is in far orbit. I think they will hit us as we cross near the sun, when our sensors are distorted. No, Kavak says, disagreeing again. They will hit Mars. Take out the Phobos dockyards, eye for an eye. And that is why we should return to Mars, Niobe says.
Kavak knows better the Rim, and I know better Atalantia. Mars cannot fall.
No one has suggested rescuing Sevro, I say. We sent three teams in through the tunnel after we evac'd you. We lost contact with them 10 minutes later. Niobe steps toward the bed. Virginia, we have four operatives still in the building under Moonhall. They are Sevro's best chance. But if we try to hammer our way in now... Massacre. And the clone kills my friends. We can't stay here, Niobe says. The Vox fleet wants a fight. They're still pursuing and we're a million clicks away from Luna. Surely Plubius can be reasoned with, Kavak says to me. To do all this, he might have used the mob, but he can be rational. If we fight his fleet, no matter who loses, gold wins. It's almost too much to bear. What do you think, Holiday? I ask. Finally, she meets my eyes. Retreat is the only option, Mom. We must regroup on Mars. If we go, that leaves Earth alone with the Vox and the swelling gold host. It will fall unless the clone sees it is in his interest to try to defend it with his Lunese fleet. But Mars can be defended without help from Luna. Earth cannot. Then we go to Mars, I say. Though I promised my husband I would come for him, I cannot. It is a betrayal that will haunt me to the grave. Kavak sags in exhaustion. He sees me notice and finally seems to see the scores of wounds the mob gave me on my exposed arms, neck and legs. I had forgotten them. The tears gather in his eyes as he leans over the bed. All hope is not lost, he whispers to me. I fail to see how he can believe that. He kisses my forehead.
I sent a man to Mercury to bring Darrow home if Heliopolis falls.
Who? I ask. The same man who told us the Rim was coming.
Chapter 58. Darrow. Sevro's Palace. Glerastes, the master maker, stands before his crudest creation. The starboard hangar of the Morning Star no longer exists. Harnassus's engineering corps have carved through the midsection of the ship to create enough room to house the Spirit of Faran, our fastest and youngest torch ship. The insides of the Faran have been almost entirely gutted to make room for the most powerful electromagnetic pulse weapon assembled in all the campaigns of the war. It is not a new device on the surface, but it is the nature of war to inspire evolution. In his purple robes, Glerastes resembles an evil necromancer from one of Pax's storybooks. His hands labor with some Byzantine contraption designed for his 14 fingers. It measures arcane readouts, the meaning of which only my wife and her Narcissus astrophysicists could ever hope to understand. Old researchers with large, roomy eyes check their own notations and murmur to one another, while the younger breed crouch in isolation, their cranial implants flickering as they attempt to keep pace with the orange idol. As the EMP finishes its 18th preliminary test, I survey the length of the device, its nest of wave-shaped coils, each three times as thick around as a man, its blue lights and vacuum tubes. A steady whoomph, whoomph comes from the oversized helium reactor at the aft of the ship. The lights dim. Thrastes clicks his tongue at his servant, who bends to scratch his inner calf. Mid-scratch, he screams at a welder for silence. The thick-set red spits tobacco juice into the can tied to his neck by a string, turns off his torch, and hangs from the ceiling on his line. The engineers and construction teams hold their collective breath, not so much in anticipation of the result, but for fear of the maker's monstrous temper. Green integers dance across his face as his eyes dart through the report, punctuating it with murmurs of, "Interesting. Perfidious instantaneous amplitude. Shit, shit, indecorous shit," and more esoteric Mercurian profanities. "Do we have a problem, Glerastes?" I ask. Glerastes sighs as if in prayer to give himself patience.
"Problem? You ask if we have a problem?"
The folds of his neck twist red as he cranes his head to glare at me like a frazzled yet contemptuous owl.
"Young man, you bamboozled me into helping you activate the storm guards under the pretense that you would use them only in a limited capacity and instead turned a city I love into a coral reef. Any compassion I had for your cause has been drowned by the encroaching sea. Yet if I do not help you again, as you so eloquently and brutally elucidated, when you browbeat me into helping you on this fool's errand to rid you from my planet, the city of my birth will resemble little else in the known universe except the center of a G-type main-sequence star. The fact that I find catharsis in profanity while endeavoring to fit 3 years' worth of research into 3 weeks of practical application does not reflect upon the enthusiasm for the work, which is little, nor the necessity, which is great. So, yes, we have a problem. But the particular nature of my frustration is isolated to a conundrum which you have neither the patience, nor the temperament, nor the cognitive ability to understand."
He turns the data on its side, scrolls through it again.
"Ah," he says. "Never mind. I solved it."
He twirls his fingers.
"You! Why did you stop welding? Get back to our work! Must I do everything?"
Glerastes stalks out of the spirit and heads for his makeshift office on the floor of the hangar.
"You're all bloody saints," I say to the welders.
"Ah, sir,"
one croons.
"Can I have a kiss?"
asks another.
"Back to work," Parnassus shouts. "We're not paying by the hour."
We find Glerastes sighing as he slumps into his thinking chair, a queer perch made from a single flowing branch of a sun blossom tree.
"I know it is beneath you," Parnassus says, as Glerastes' servant pours his master a glass of port. "But would you mind explaining the device to the infantry, Master Maker? It would do them some comfort to know they're not trusting their lives to magic."
Glerastes surveys the commanders I brought with me.
"No, that sounds tiresome."
He puts his feet on a silk stool and sighs as his servant removes his purple slippers and massages his heels with rose oil. Parnassus looks 6 seconds away from clouting Glerastes on the ears. He has little patience for snobs. I've more experience with the breed.
"It's just an EMP. What's so complicated about scaling it up?" I say,
and wait for the explosion.
"Just an EMP?
Glerastes repeats, as if reading his own obituary aloud.
"Am I just an ambulating mammal?"
His eyes scour me. Did you not retain anything of your curriculum from the academy aside from astral belligerency?
I retained enough, apparently.
The infantry commanders chuckle. Glirastes sighs in annoyance and regards Thraxa and my infantry commanders with distaste, offended by the sunburned visages and thick chests of hardier mammals than he, and retreats to intellectual bullying. I track what he says, because I'm married to a woman who'd be insulted if I couldn't.
Weaponized transient electromagnetic disturbances have tenaciously sharp leading wave edges, escalating precipitously to their maximum level before decaying slowly. Imagine a double exponential curve. Problematically, the shielding made by the Venusian dockyards is designed to recognize this sort of blunt belligerency.
He fixes me with a glare.
And provide countermeasures for Atalantis' fleet. Consequently, I have decided to use a benign, damped sine wave to create a coupling between the source and the victim equipment. Usually, this is a byproduct of a weaponized EMP. But the genius here is that instead of diminishing within the double exponential envelope, the sine wave wavelengths will increase. However, considering the distance required, the energy demand will be staggering. Creating a more efficient and staggered energy ignition is profoundly difficult absent a nuclear explosion, and if I do not perfect it, you will all die in the sky.
He eyes me again.
Now that I have satisfied the curiosity of your apes, the zoo is closed.
He closes his eyes.
Begone! Lest you have an advanced degree, or care to replace Exeter in massaging my feet.
I'll take his spot if you like, Master Maker, Thraxa says with a smile. She holds up her hands. I know they look like elephant feet, but they're tender to the right sort.
Glirastes makes a face of distaste.
Such a bloodline, squandered on martial absurdity. You've genius in your line, woman. Your brother was the mind of a generation, and your father...
He sighs.
You waste your time playing soldier.
So that's a pass.
Pah.
He shoots Harnassus a look.
Don't forget my breakfast tomorrow. I can't work without sardines.
Tomorrow is a Tuesday, after all.
As my infantry commanders file out muttering their concerns to one another, Harnassus follows me and Thraxa out of the star's hangar. What do you think? I ask him.
He's pig-headed, cruel, eccentric, fickle, and 10 times as demanding as my first wife. But he's a genius.
Was, Thraxa says. Riches made him slow.
She glares back at the man. Little more than a lapdog to whoever holds Mercury.
You thinking he'll betray us? I ask.
I'm thinking we should endeavor to remind him Atalantia is scared of us.
What do you have against him? I ask.
First off, his designs are rubbish, robbing the Egyptians blind. And the bastard cozied up to the slavers, then to us. He's a bloodfly, invertebrate. Permission to pop him when we evac.
Denied, psycho, Harnassus says.
Wasn't asking you.
He's my second in command, Thraxa. When I don't speak, he speaks for me, I remind her.
Uh-huh. But you're speaking.
You're not killing the Master Maker.
She shrugs.
Sure.
Where were we? I ask Harnassus.
Can we even tell if he's full of shit? If he leaves us hanging up there, we're all dead.
He's spineless, Thraxa moans. He wouldn't dare cross us.
Probably right, Harnassus grimaces.
See, I'm not the sharpest on magnetism or waveform theory. My focus was practical mechanics. But I've got 200 brains with 1,000 degrees between them going step for step with him.
He's smarter than each one of them in theory, but not all of them together.
If he's playing games, they'll red flag it. Long as we keep him happy, Seems he'll do what we need him to do. That's the trick, isn't it? I say. You want the genius happy? We need sardines, Anassa says. Sardines. He says he gets headaches without sardines for breakfast on Tuesdays. Tomorrow is Tuesday, and he's fresh out. You have to be joking, I say, for Thraxa. I don't damn well know. This man's been pissing into crystal decanter since he was a teenager. So far, no luck. If the Heliopolitan Silvers here have sardines, they're denying it. We could raid their kitchens, but we're on unsteady footing as it is. Where's Severo when you need him? I mutter. Onassis raises an eyebrow in query. What? You think he just always smells like fish? Thraxa asks. I think he smells like wet dog, personally, I reply. Well, it depends if it's raining or not. Gods, the jungles were rough. You remember that trench foot he had? Thought we'd have to amputate, Thraxa says. Yeah, you tried. Then he woke up. That was funny. Onassis shakes his head. This is not the conversation I thought I would have when the Reaper of Mars came to North Africa to make me a praetor. I thought it'd be all fire and guts and devilish mayhem, not prepubescent humour. You should check Severo's pantry. All sorts of illicit goods there, so I hear. Why don't you check it? I ask. I won't send any of my men in there. I sigh and motion Rona over from my bodyguards. Go see if there's any sardines in Imperator Barker's stateroom. She goes white as a corpse. Isn't that a task for support? Not you, too. It's just... Well, there's booby traps, ain't there? Alexander once tried to steal whiskey, came back shaking like a softfoot on their first aerial drop. Fine. My bodyguards all find something very interesting in the contours of the deck. Superstitious idiots. I'll get the bloody damn sardines. 10 minutes later, I'm shrieking like a goat on the floor just inside Severo's room as a medicus pulls needles from my face, chest, and ass. Incredible pain races through my body as my hands and feet turn purple and start to swell uncontrollably. A flat voice drawls from a hologram of Severo's face. Don't touch my shit. Don't touch my shit. Don't touch my shit. It's prime, sir, the yellow says to me as she injects me with anti-venom. It's prime. The pain will subside in a minute. Swelling should start to go down now. Sadly, the colour will remain. She looks up at Severo's hologram. I'll wait outside. In case you need me. Told you, Rona says from the door. Slag off. When my hands have almost returned to their normal size and feeling has returned to my feet, I stagger up and turn off the hologram. A hidden needle pricks my finger. Shit. Badass class DNA detected, a sexy voice says. Nothing leaps at me from the darkness. Profile match for Darrow of Lycos, best friend, also known as Reaper, Boss, Howler One, Apex Asshole, Brother, Mustang's Bitch. Second class clearance granted. Welcome. I apologize for warning shots. Master has been notified of your skulking. Sticky finger traps deactivated. Help yourself to a glass of scotch. Best friend. Take in some music, Reaper. Admire the trophies from the decimated enemies of the noble Howlers, Boss. Enjoy the extensive pornography library, Howler One. Relax in the sauna, Apex Asshole. It has no traps. But above all else, steal nothing and enjoy your stay in
Severo's Palace.
Severo's voice adds very seriously. Second class, I ask. Yes, Master says you know why.
I look back to Rona at the door. Nope, Rona says, and bugs out. Screwface makes a motion of standing guard and ducks into the hall. Pixie, I mutter, and shut the door. The suite is large, comprised of half a dozen rooms filled with his prizes. I've avoided this place since arriving on Mercury. To be here is to be reminded of how we parted. The place is too much like my friend. Mugs of evaporated whiskey sit in ranks atop banners of fallen warlords he's trampled. Candy wrappers fill the eye holes of solid gold skulls taken from Magnus's floating palace in Africa. The scepter I gave Adrius in Attica sits on the couch for Sevro to use as a back scratcher. Only one place is spared the chaos strewn throughout the suite. My wife once told me, a man's soul can be seen in the rooms he keeps the cleanest. I asked her, what room is my soul? She tapped my razor. Sevro's soul is his armory, but for a different reason. One wall is for use. Three suits of Sevro's wolf armor hang central on the longest wall, surrounded by a shrine of knives. Tickler, his favorite, is missing. Replacement razors gleam with oil. Several from the gens Falth are there, as is the Minotaur's with its horned pommel. I gave it to Sevro as a gift when his youngest was born. He always coveted it, especially after Sephi won Azure's off him in a game of who gets the most kills. Pulse fists and more esoteric weapons fill the rest of the shelves. One wall is for memories. One of Ragnar's razors. Weed's old pipe. Quinn's howler cloak. The bloody cape Octavia Auloon wore the day I killed her. Highest on the wall, in a place of honor, is the sling blade I used at the Institute. I look at it for a long time before I take it down. It is far heavier than my razor, and falls smaller than I remember. I swing it till it makes a swish, swish. I laughed at him when I saw it there the first time. Laughed even harder when I found out how much trouble he went through to track it down. But I think I skipped past the part that mattered. How much the blade meant to him. With his father always away, always secretive and frightened to show his love, that blade gave Sevro something to follow. Something to dedicate his life to, until he found something else. The last wall is for his family. Hollows of his girls float above coin-sized projectors so that it seems like 100 reveries fill the shelves. They've danced here in the darkness without anyone to see them for months. There are little bracelets and tokens, ink footprints and palm paintings. An emerald cape Victor gave to him when we sailed for Earth, a golden unicorn figurine. And in the center of it all, his father's blood-red Ares armor with its spiked crescent helmet. The bench where he would dress for battle faces this wall. The armor looks so odd, surrounded by the domesticity. But it is easy for me to forget that Sevro's life was always war, because his father waged it, instead of raising him. After I saw how Lorne's sons were consumed by his vocation, and theirs continue to be consumed, I tried to separate war and family, like Fichtner. I thought they were two worlds that should never meet. Sevro knew what I did not. What it is like to be raised by a warlord, by a distracted man. And he knew that our world is one where everything collides. He didn't close his mind to his family before battle because he knew they did not make him weaker. They made him stronger than he was by himself. I feel the key underneath my jacket. Even though I will never be able to agree with his decision to return to Luna instead of Mercury, I understand it. He even said it to me. Though I did not want to hear it at the time. He would not make the same mistakes as his father.
If I ever see him again, I will ask that he forgive me asking him to make that impossible choice. And if I see my boy again, if I see my wife, I will not close myself off to them. I will be the father and husband they deserve.
Chapter 59. Lysander. The Impaler. I am one of the tortured. The Gorgons, a handsome gold woman with a pert nose and a gecko of a grey, pour alcohol over my burn on the first day. Just getting acquainted, they say, as I scream. They inject something into my neck, and time does indeed slow down. The agony sustains itself for what feels like a week. Then it is gone, and the pain of my burn is omnipotent once more. The Gorgons ask about the Bellona blade they found on me, about my name, but if I give it to them, then what will they do with it? The Fear Knight is away, so it seems. Would they contact the Anihilo? Would Ajax intercept it and send a kill squad here to finish what he started, and Seneca left incomplete? I need the Fear Knight to return. I need his direct authority. My stomach feels inside out, it's so hungry. My hair has begun to fall out from radiation sickness. Soon all of us are bald. All of us are nauseous. Our bodies are naturally resistant to radiation, but with it floating in continuously from the Ladan, our DNA unwinds bit by bit. Soon the symptoms will worsen. The Elysian Knights and I talk intermittently as the days ebb and flow. I look for some sign of insanity in them to explain their allegiance to Darrow and the betrayal of their own colour, but I detect none, except for the zealotry in Alexandra and Drusilla. The rest seem only to be here because House Arcus, their patron, joined years ago. Drusilla speaks of the dream of Persephone, of helping the people, as if all low colours were paupers and slaves before the rising. It's a laugh. I've met reds and browns happier than most golds I know, and all of them with better lives than the greys who fed our military machine. But greys never broke under the hardship. Of all the colours, they've remained the most loyal to the society. Sometime in the morning, on what may be my fourth day with them, Ignatius and Drusilla are taken away. Ignatius is returned first, sheet white, and holding three stumps where there used to be fingers. When Drusilla returns, she says nothing as she sobs into the stone. Any belief that I am a plant among the Arcosians disappears. The torture binds me to their pack, as I supposed it would. Conversation becomes scarce. Slowly Alexander draws in on himself, becoming dour and hopeless. It is all Drusilla can do to keep him drinking water and eating their gruel. My scheme begins to seem so foolish. There is nothing to be gained out of the misunderstanding that brought me here. I will die here, or I will risk telling my captors who I am and wait at their mercy for my enemies to decide my fate. I've resolved to tell them, when I am strung up on the chains for the fifth time, the time dilation drug is too much to bear, and even the mind's eye cannot spare me from its rigours. But Pert and Gecko, as I've taken to calling my torturers, disappear once I'm hoisted up. The cavern is dim and unadorned. Stalactites drip water into a shallow pool. Beside that is a chest full of torture devices. I hear footsteps behind me. A man breathing.
"Can you walk?" he asks,
his accent more Lunese than Ionian. I nod. A mag key unlatches the lock on my manacles.
"Follow me."
I follow the man out of the cavern to a main tunnel. To the left, past the prisoner's cavern, come the faint sounds of laughter and cooking. He leads me right into deeper tunnels until we come to a small cavern. It is his personal chamber. A thin thermofoam mattress with a field blanket serves as his bed. A small solar stove sits in a nook carved into the wall, along with several weapons and a long-range comm. A thin black haster hangs on the wall beside a filthy wolf pelt. A second nook is home to several dozen figurines carved from disparate stones. Beside it is a map of what looks like a cave system. I join him to sit on two small pads facing each other. Atlas Aura is a vaguely alien man. It has been years since I've seen him in the flesh. After the death of my parents, he was sent to the Rim to harry the Azkamani and the Kuiper. Whatever he did to displease my grandmother must have been grave. In his absence, she gifted his office to another. I am struck by how soulful he now seems. Was it the distant dark that did it, or was it the war he returned to find raging in his absence? Behind the sunburnt eyelids lurks an intense intellectual presence. He is masculine like his son Ajax, but nowhere near as thick. He is taller and leaner than his brother Romulus, but less dramatic in posture. His eyes are wider and a clearer gold. A scar encircles his neck where his throat was once cut ear to ear. His long hair is black, shot with gold, and held back in a ponytail. I probe deeper with the mind's eye. 49 years of age, left-handed, limp originating from the left knee, multiple hidden knives in his moth-coloured light armour, lack of ego projection, indicating absence of insecurity in body and deeds. Sociopathy? Delusions of heroism? No, that's usually supported by zeal. Why so distant? Extremely lonely, tired, bored, distracted, absent in his personal presentation is the theatricality of his public work, which suggests a sophisticated system of operation, likely supported by the books in his library, and perhaps a personal philosophical treatise. This is a philosopher-torturer, with the practical detachment of a pig-butcher. "Stop that," he says, "unless you want me to do it back." I go still. Grandmother said I was her only pupil. Could this be why Apollonius wants it so bad? He knows Atlas is yet beyond him. The man's cold eyes search the burn on my face and continue to assess without yet coming to a conclusion. So he is humble, too, or at least experienced enough to have been wrong more than once before.
"Salve, Auloon," he says in formal high lingo.
"Salve, Aura," I reply.
"How did my brother die?" he asks,
abandoning the argot before it becomes laborious.
"Of course I have been told, but I hear you saw it with your own eyes."
"He walked to the dragon tomb. He died several steps short." He is quiet for a full minute.
"All men who live for their ancestors do. How long did he talk before he walked?"
"Too long."
He chuckles, Romulus to the end. "I hear my niece and nephew are on the Anihilo to talk alliance."
"Diomedes is. Serafina is in the desert." He doesn't flinch.
"Dead?"
"Yes, Atalantia demanded Ara participate."
"Did you see her corpse?"
"I saw her ripped in half by a rail slug. What remained was buried in the sand."
"Shadows and dust," he murmurs
without irony. "No grief, no laugh for the dead traitor."
"She did not betray the society. My father and brother did. I held no malice for Serafina. I would have liked to have known my kin."
He sighs and takes the Bellona razor from a pouch on his thigh and lays it between us.
"This, on the other hand, is filthy with the blood of Arja and Octavia."
"I do not believe a man like you should ask anyone to explain themselves."
"Ah, that's right. You've seen one of my forests. I'm sure you have an opinion. The 200 had many at first. None to my face, of course. They prefer smiles and innuendo."
"I remember you used to make my father laugh," I say. His eyes soften.
"Do you? I wonder if he would laugh at your forests. No, he surprises me by saying, Brutus would call me a human stain. Anastasia would use far gentler a vocabulary. I'm sure you remember her bleeding heart. No, as a matter of fact. He searches my face as if trying to detect a lie. She would say I am making more enemies with every man I impale. That is why I impale Martians, not Mercurians. To create dissonance and demarcation between interloper and loyal subject, I reply pedantically. So we've read some of the same books, I see. You want to play this game? Very well. I've only barbarians for company out here. How many lives did you end in the Iron Rain? Don't you have a kill count to mark on your breastplate? It is impossible to reckon. Between 10 and 100? Do you feel their deaths acutely? Vaguely. There it is. He leans back. Distance has sanitized war nearly as much as Stoneside's fucking ramblings. It has made it easy, romantic. I have no interest in sanitization nor romance. I apply scientific methods to produce psychological trauma in our enemies in order to create psychological casualties, to end their willingness to fight and shorten this war. That is my purpose. There's a resentment in him, a hostility that seems intensely personal. I don't recall knowing him well enough to wound him, or does he already know of Ajax's betrayal? Enough digression. Why would you tell my men you are this Cato au Vitruvius? Did it amuse you? Amuse me? What sort of nature do you think I possess? A nature which is the product of your grandmother, the same nature she imparted to all her students. Answer the question. So that's who the anger is for, the woman who gave him this role? I didn't trust your men, I say. Ajax tried to assassinate me twice. By his expression, I see this is not news. I could not risk revealing my identity to anyone but you, for fear of him completing the task. And you think I am trustworthy? He asks. You were my father's best friend. I am also Ajax's father. He picks at his cuticles. Do you mean to kill my son? No. He doesn't believe me. Do you even know why Ajax tried to kill you? It goes back to childhood. He laughs. It does indeed. She used to groom the both of you. He leans forward. Ajax is fucking Atalantia. At first I thought I misheard, but it begins to make sense. Ajax is quiet when Atalantia kissed me, his territorial marking, his fear that I would replace him at his aunt's side. You didn't know. Few do. She took my son as a paramour before he turned 16. She would reward him for the heads of gold blood traitors with sexual favours. Did Magnus know? Of his daughter's depravity, yes. Of its deeper depths, and my son's sexual enslavement to his remaining daughter. He shrugs. Magnus always had a selective conscience, especially with precious Atalantia. And you just let it happen. Ajax may have my DNA, but I was off fighting for my sovereign for half his life. When I returned, well, that boy is her creature to the bone now, just as she intended. She and Arja always detested each other, you know. That Arja's boy is now her personal killing machine is her ultimate revenge. Did Atalantia give the order to kill me? I doubt it. To do so would be to admit to herself that she cannot tame you, he says. She would not lose such a prize as you lightly, but if she did give the order, she would not tell me. He pulls a fig from a bag and pops it into his mouth, offering me one. I take three.
So long as Ajax is ruled by his heart and cock, there will be no place for the boy who used to make him feel small. Knowing this, you still claim no intent on his life.
It changes nothing, I reply. I am here for the people of the society, for Kalindora, for my Praetorians. I will not let them burn as hostages of the enemy. I know an assault is pending on Heliopolis. I assume Darrow is besieged there. He watches me without speaking for some time.
You look very much like your mother when you feign nobility, you know.
He ponders over a fig.
It won't be an assault. I have recently concluded field testing of a new chemical weapon. Atalantia is intent on releasing it, so she does not destroy Heliopolis's wealth before taking it as her own. The Master Maker will watch as his city eats itself.
What does the chemical do?
Omnicide.
I see it already. A catalogue of horrors racks Kalindora's face. I see her convulsing and vomiting blood. I see buboes bubbling on her skin. I see the skin melting away. I did not know until this moment how much I would do to stop that. She is a killer, but the weariness